KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's not just pointless suffering. There's things that are happening, there's people doing the work, and there's obvious ways we can improve and just figuring out how to do that.
Deaths from fentanyl are way down in the U.S. That is a public health win.
Now cities are trying to help people who are alive and addicted.
For Monday, March 10th, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ahead this hour, President Trump wants to move Palestinians out of Gaza.
In Israel, the idea is gaining steam.
I think this idea is dramatic and crazy, but the situation is also crazy. We cannot keep living like this.
Also, new music that's a love letter to a friend who died from cancer.
Everyone suffers in different ways, but we need to see examples of more people suffering and blossoming.
Speaking of music, Joni Mitchell's song California came out in 1971.
So why has it just gone viral on TikTok?
We'll find out. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, says former President Biden will not have access to a daily intelligence briefing. As NPR's Greg Myrie explains, Gabbard also revoked security clearances for dozens of former government officials.
As a courtesy, former presidents usually receive access to classified information, including the president's daily intelligence briefing. But President Biden didn't grant such access to Donald Trump after his first term, and now President Trump is not allowing Biden to see the daily briefing. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard said on social media she was acting on Trump's orders. She's also revoking security clearances for more than 50 ex-national security officials. They include former Secretary of State Antony Blinken and former National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Ukrainian officials meet with the U.S. delegation in Saudi Arabia tomorrow to find a framework for a potential ceasefire agreement with Russia. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Ukrainians say they want to end the war but are worried a ceasefire won't last.
36-year-old architect Dmytro Reifschneider is waiting for a bus with his wife Olena in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. He says a lasting ceasefire must have security guarantees that President Trump has so far refused to promise.
We don't want just freeze the line now and they come again to us in 1, 2, 3 years or in 10 years. We don't want this. And that's why I think all Ukrainian people want peace, but very long.
The couple says they want to raise their child in a peaceful democracy, not Putin's dictatorship. But they say this is only possible if the U.S. and Europe lay out serious consequences if Russia violates the agreement. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Lviv.
What's it take to accelerate a massive sell-off on Wall Street? Well, apparently a short pause from a president when asked about the prospect of U.S. economy and recession is one way to go about it. More from NPR's Marie Aspen.
Yesterday, Fox News aired an interview with Trump that got everyone more worried. Fox News anchor Maria Bartiromo asked Trump this.
Are you expecting a recession this year?
I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition because what we're doing is very big. We're bringing wealth back to America. That's a big thing.
U.S. stocks posted their single biggest downturn of the year today, with all three of the U.S. stock indexes falling 2% or more. In the case of the NASDAQ, it dropped more than 4%. That included a 15% plunge in the stock of electric vehicle maker Tesla. Looking at the numbers, the Dow was down nearly 900 points. The NASDAQ fell 727 points. The S&P 500 lost 155 points. This is NPR. The Senate has confirmed Lori Chavez de Remer as U.S. Labor Secretary, cabinet post putting her in charge of enforcing federal labor law. Chavez de Remer will oversee the Labor Department, one of several executive departments named in lawsuits challenging the authority of billionaire Elon Musk and his cost-cutting Doge Group to access sensitive government data. Among other things, the department reports the U.S. unemployment rate, regulates workplace health and safety, and investigates pay disputes. To mark the 200th anniversary of the birth of composer Johann Strauss, his most famous composition, The Blue Danube, will be beamed into space, a collaboration between the European Space Agency and the Vienna Symphony. The live performance will be transmitted into the cosmos in May, as Jeff London reports.
Stanley Kubrick's film 2001: A Space Odyssey made the Blue Danube waltz synonymous with space. Now it's becoming a reality. When the Vienna Symphony plays the Johann Strauss Waltz live on the evening of May 31st, it will be transmitted by electromagnetic wave at the speed of light from a deep space antenna in Cebrero, Spain. According to the European Space Agency, the sound will reach NASA's Voyager 1 in deep space 23 hours later. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
Crude oil futures prices follow the general market lower today. Oil down just over $1 a barrel to settle at $66.03 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here is a hopeful statistic. In the U.S., deaths from overdoses of fentanyl are plummeting. They're down over 30% year over year. That's according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Some addiction experts believe the deadliest wave of the fentanyl crisis may finally be over. Now, that does present a new challenge. Many communities must now help the growing number of fentanyl survivors who are still deeply unwell. NPR's Brian Mann has our story from Philadelphia.
On a late winter morning, Kaylee McLeod with Philadelphia's Overdose Response Unit sets off on foot across Kensington, one of the most drug-scarred neighborhoods in the U.S.
Hey, sir. You all right? You okay?
In the first block, she kneels next to a man curled up on the sidewalk.
He's good? You good? All right, I can see him moving. He's good.
Good means still alive. But the growing number of people who survive fentanyl overdoses still face complicated health problems, many still severely addicted, often with skin wounds, bacterial infections, and cardiovascular disease.
It's absolutely heartbreaking to see people live in these conditions.
The city is pushing hard to clean up Kensington, but in the shadow of the elevated train track, people slump against abandoned buildings. A few blocks down the street, men and women crowd outside a warming shelter called the Sunshine House, run by Rosalind Pichardo.
There's a little smoke in here. We're making some bacon.
People can get a meal here and clean clothes and maybe a new winter coat.
I call them my sunshines, so we serve a lot of sunshines here.
They can also get naloxone, also known as Narcan. It's the overdose reversal drug. Pichardo says she personally has brought back more than 2,000 people overdosing on fentanyl.
Everyone carries naloxone, so it does save lives all over Kensington, all over the city.
This is why I'm here. Kensington often looks grim, but things are better. Thanks in part to naloxone, Pennsylvania is seeing roughly 2,000 fewer drug overdose deaths a year. It's part of a dramatic national improvement that stunned addiction experts like Nabarun Dasgupta.
It has been a complete shock to see the numbers declining in the way that they have been.
Dasgupta's new study at the University of North Carolina found the drop in drug deaths nationally is big, with all states seeing at least some improvement, and many states, like Pennsylvania, experiencing 30% fewer fatal overdoses. That's a huge public health accomplishment. But Dasgupta says the trend creates a new challenge.
Initially, it's been kind of this panic mode of preventing deaths. But now that we have found some effective ways to keep people alive, it's really important to try to reach out to them and help them improve their whole lives.
That's a tall order. The distance from where the U.S. is now in places like Kensington to that kind of public health response feels vast. As Kaylee McLeod heads back out on the street, she bends to check on another man huddled and unresponsive.
He's not dead, but he's not okay.
The complicated reality is that more people surviving fentanyl overdoses will mean more people needing a whole network of care.
When we say, you know, this person is ready to go to substance use treatment, oh, but they have an amputation, they have an open wound, they have incredibly high blood pressure. You know, historically, our system is not built for that person.
A few blocks down the street, I meet Tracy Horvath, who says she's lived in Kensington most of her life, much of that time using fentanyl.
I relapsed like a week ago, but I'm trying to stay clean.
She looks weary and cold, but she is one of the survivors. Horvath, too, says fentanyl might have killed her if Narcan weren't so widely available.
I only used a little bit and I still overdosed.
I ask what she'd need to move beyond this life, beyond addiction. Horvath says her first goal is a safe place to live.
Stable housing.
Addiction care experts say getting people off the street into homes is often a crucial step, but there are so many needs here it can feel overwhelming. Kayla McLeod says there has been progress building a network of services and support that didn't exist a decade ago.
There's one of our partners, the Kensington Hospital Wound Care Van.
We pass a mobile healthcare team and a food pantry. There's a special police unit trained in addiction response and a group from a university dispensing buprenorphine, a medication that reduces fentanyl cravings. I meet Scout Gilson working at a syringe exchange run by a group called Prevention Point.
I was addicted to heroin and then eventually fentanyl.
Gilson, who's in long-term recovery, says she knows firsthand how complicated the health impacts of drug use can be, from mental health challenges to lingering skin wounds.
I'm covered in scars. Like, I am heavily scarred. I am pretty much marked forever as a drug user.
But Gilson thinks deeper healing that moves people beyond survival is possible with the right help.
It's not just pointless suffering. There's things that are happening. There's people doing the work. And there's obvious ways we can improve and just figuring out how to do that.
In my time in Philadelphia, I see examples of this hopeful work, and I meet people like Gilson who've managed to rebuild their lives. But the need is clearly growing here in Kensington and around the U.S. One question is whether there will be money to pay for these services. So far, the Trump administration has focused largely on keeping fentanyl out of the U.S., not on programs that help people recover. Some Republicans in Congress are still talking about budget cuts that could affect Medicaid. That's the federal program that funds most addiction treatment in the U.S. I asked Kayla McLeod with Philadelphia's Overdose Response Unit if she's hopeful, despite all the desperate need and the uncertainty. After a moment, she nods a cautious yes.
And so we just, you know, work our best to help people be well and keep trying.
But it took years to slow fentanyl deaths in the U.S. McLeod says healing people in neighborhoods like Kensington will take more resources and a lot more time. Brian Mann, NPR News, Philadelphia.
President Trump's idea to move Palestinians out of Gaza has taken on a life of its own in Israel. Israeli officials say they're working on a plan to create a migration authority to help the people of Gaza leave. And surveys suggest the majority of Israelis are open to the idea. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
The hearing Sunday in Israel's parliament was titled The New Middle East, the Plan for Voluntary Emigration from Gaza. Ultranationalist lawmakers discussed how to turn President Trump's recent proposal into reality. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said this is a potential for historic change. He said most of Gaza's 2 million people could be gone within half a year, and that Israel is working with the U.S. to find countries to take them in. Chinese and Panamanian diplomats were sitting at the roundtable, chaired by right-wing lawmaker Simcha Rotman.
Getting the population out of there because they are in a grave danger when they stay there, and they pose a grave danger to us when they are there, this makes sense.
He's making a humanitarian case, removing Gazans from the destruction after Israel's war on Hamas, and a security argument that the whole population of Gaza poses a danger to Israelis after the Hamas attack October 7th, 2023. In Gaza, some say they'll never agree to be displaced from their homes.
Others say they'd welcome the opportunity to move away for a better life. Lawmaker Osher Shkalim and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party said leaving Gaza should not be voluntary. It's either us or them, he said. Anyone who defines themselves as Palestinian is saying, I am your enemy, I don't want you here. The concept of Palestinian population transfer used to be considered taboo in Israel. The party that advocated it in the 1980s was banned from parliament as racist. Now Trump and Netanyahu praise the idea. A poll this week from the Israel Democracy Institute found 73% of Jews living in Israel believe that whether or not it's practical, Trump's plan has started a more relevant discussion of possible solutions for ending the war. At an outdoor coffee shop in Jerusalem, several Israelis say getting Gazans to leave Gaza would pose problems, but might be ideal. 27-year-old medical student Itamar Lavi.
I think this idea is dramatic and crazy, but the situation is also crazy. We cannot keep living like this. I think it's horrible to move population, but maybe eventually it will be also better for them because right now they live actually in a ghetto.
A few tables over is 30-year-old dentist Lisa Dreyer with her dog.
I would like it to happen, but I'm not sure it's the practical right solution because then there will be more stories about more lands that we took over, that we occupied, that we were violent towards. So I really feel it will lead to more harsh feelings towards Israel.
President Trump's idea is to get Gazans away from the rubble and resettle them in neighboring countries to have better lives. Dozens of Arab countries have rejected displacement, calling it ethnic cleansing. There's little objection from prominent opposition politicians in Israel. Centrist lawmaker Alon Schuster says Palestinians should be able to make up their own mind, but he's afraid to evoke dark chapters of Jewish history.
Don't want to be in a place where the Jewish state is pushing people from their home if they don't want to.
The right-wing lawmakers in the hearing acknowledged they were discussing Gazans leaving Gaza in theory. What they said was important was Trump helping shift the Israeli discourse. As Yuli Edelstein, a member of Netanyahu's party, said, something that was once forbidden to talk about now seems, quote, super legitimate to discuss. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From EasyCater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Koreatown here in Los Angeles is massive. It's like a whole city within the city. And for the electronic artist Jennifer Lee, also known as Tokimonsta, K-Town has been a top hangout spot ever since she was a kid.
I grew up in Torrance, so it's very close.
Yeah.
And I'd come here all the time with my family to go eat at the restaurants. Or
Lee's family is Korean-American, and after she moved out on her own, she lived right here in the heart of K-Town, just down the block from this turquoise Art Deco tower soaring above us, the famous music venue known as the Wiltern.
I'm so curious, like when you used to hang out in K-Town when you were younger, would you look at the Wiltern and be like, I want to perform there one day?
When I looked at places like the Wiltern, it wasn't like I aspired. I never thought I'd be able to play there, but it was iconic, and I love this venue. And to say that I've been able to play it maybe once or twice now,
is pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's so much a part of my childhood. Like, even my mom knows what the Wiltern is. She doesn't know what happens inside it. I feel like I'm on something on you. I got
something I just gotta run through. Lee will be hitting stages across the country again soon to launch her latest album. It's called Eternal Reverie, and it features many familiar collaborators like Gavin Turek and Anderson .Paak. Yeah, I'm feeling like I need you in my life, damn right. I've been picking fights just to get a rise out of you. 10 years ago, Lee was in a very different place in her career and in her life. She was diagnosed with a potentially fatal brain disease and underwent 2 back-to-back brain surgeries barely a week apart. The procedures left her unable to speak for a while, unable to understand language, even unable to comprehend music. And so there was a period of time when the very idea of making music again felt completely out of reach.
Music is my life. It's my career. I think being able to hear it again was great, but knowing that making it was not in the cards for me was something that was highly discouraging. So I just closed my laptop, put it away, and decided I will address this later.
That's so strong to be able to do that, just to let yourself take the time.
I mean, there was no other way around it. I was like, I clearly can't do this anymore. And yeah, just like a week or 2 weeks later, I decided, let's try this one more time. And I brought my laptop back out, and I worked on a song, and it was beautiful. It was incredible within a week how much my brain had changed and recovered. A song that ended up being on my next album.
Now, several albums, several years after that experience, Tokimonsta says rediscovering that joy of writing music again, that was the intention behind this latest album.
The celebration of the dreamer I was when I was younger, the dreamer that never knew that they could play the Wiltern.
Right.
You know, the musician, the creative, this spirit that was so excited about what the future held and the possibilities that were endless.
The name of the album makes sense to me now, Eternal Reverie.
Exactly.
You're reconnecting with that young dreamer.
Exactly. And, you know, life is hard. Life is hard for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that little dreamer inside you has to go away.
I want to take the time to talk about a personal story behind this album, because I understand that the album was supposed to come out last fall. You had a whole series of shows lined up, but then you had to postpone the album and the tour
because your best friend was diagnosed with cancer and you decided you want to take the time to be with her, to take care of her, to help take care of her. Can you tell me about that decision?
Yeah, it's a fairly difficult one to talk about because I'm still sort of like going through I am actively going through the grieving process. My best friend, Regina, was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer in September, kind of like maybe 2 or 3 weeks before my album was going to come out. She was sent to the hospital, and at that point, she never left. We decided to put her in hospice, and we just shepherded her on her way out. And
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about Regina, why she became such an important friend in your life?
Yeah, she's so much more, right? She's like a sister, and she'd always say we're chosen family. She's also a big part of my musical journey. She's someone who influenced me in so many ways, especially my artistic journey. And in fact, on this album, there's a track, Corazon. It's the one with the Brazilian sample. I wouldn't have made that track without Regina. Because she was with me in Brazil in Sao Paulo. I was playing a festival, and she's the one who pointed out the guy selling vinyl on the street. One of those records ended up being the source material for Corazon, and without her, that wouldn't have been made.
It sounds like Regina lives on through this album in some ways, not only from the Brazilian vocal sample in Corazon, but there's a song on this album that you've said is sort of a tribute to her.
Yes, so For You is a song that was made before her passing, but then it was a song that I made with her in mind. Actually, quite a few songs I made with her in mind because she was undergoing chemo. This is before she had the prognosis that it was a lot more imminent. But when she was just like, want to keep her in a good mood, and I'll take her to chemo and listen to music, and in the end, I feel like For You is the epitome of what Regina loved in my music. That's the one where I was like, this is my like love letter to my friend. It's been really difficult to go through this release process because I do have to talk about her a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a part of the story of this album, and it really sucks to talk about someone that you've lost. And it's also important because everyone suffers in different ways, but we need to see examples of more people suffering and blossoming. Every day I was with her, I let her know how much I loved her, and hopefully if her spirit or her energy or whatever, you know, is out there, I hope she knows how much I love her, so.
I have a feeling she's listening to this album.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jen, for being so incredibly open today and sharing this afternoon with us.
Yeah, no, of course. I'm happy to share publicly. These are all my therapy sessions now.
Toki Monsta. Her new album is called Eternal Reverie.
This is NPR News.
The American auto industry has been hit hard by the threat of tariffs. Stocks have been falling since President Donald Trump announced plans for tariffs on Mexico, China, and Canada. Tesla's stock has seen an even steeper decline than most car manufacturers. So what's driving Tesla's downturn? That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. King Charles, yes, that King Charles, has dropped a playlist. It features disco and Beyonce.
Cue Charles and Camilla boogieing to Crazy in Love.
Yeah, who knows what goes on behind the doors of Buckingham Palace? Maybe it's a non-stop party soundtracked by Afrobeat.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Premier of Ontario, Canada, has announced that the province will begin charging 25% more for electricity to three U.S. states. Premier Doug Ford says this comes in response to President Trump's tariffs. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
Premier Doug Ford says a decision to place tariffs on Ontario electricity will affect 1.5 million homes and businesses in Michigan, New York, and Minnesota, and that he could turn off the electricity completely if President Trump escalates his tariff war. Early last week, Trump slapped 25% tariffs on Canadian goods, then suspended them for a month. Ford says Ontario's tariffs on the U.S. will stay in place until Trump completely abandons the trade war. Ford has also ordered all American alcohol off store shelves and banned U.S. companies from bidding on Ontario government contracts. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
In Washington, D.C., crews are starting to remove a mural that covered a two-block-long stretch of road near the White House with the words Black Lives Matter in giant yellow letters. The city is also expected to rename Black Lives Matter Plaza after a member of Congress, and the Trump administration threatened to pull federal funding unless the name was changed. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says the federal government holds far more power over the district than it does over other cities.
We estimate that 40,000 D.C. residents will be put out of work through no fault of their own in this process. And we also recognize that there are a lot of questions about the legality of these actions.
Many of those D.C. residents are African Americans who have worked and lived in the district for decades, where the mass government firings have been especially prevalent. Stocks finished sharply lower today on Wall Street. This is NPR. The Attorney General for Washington State is suing a local county there over immigration enforcement. That suit alleges the county sheriff is violating a state law, as Owen Henderson of Spokane Public Radio reports.
Washington Attorney General Nick Brown says the Adams County Sheriff's Office has held people in custody based only on their immigration status, helped federal agents question people in custody, and given the personal information of Washington residents to immigration officials.
They don't deny that they're violating state law.
Previously, the county had worked with the AG's office to comply with Washington's law.
But after Trump took office in January of this year, they asserted for the first time that coming into compliance with state law would violate federal law.
In a statement, the Adams County Sheriff called the state's lawsuit disappointing and claimed Washington's law is an attempt to tie the hands of law enforcement. For NPR News, I'm Owen Henderson in Spokane.
The Dow lost almost 900 points, capping one of the worst days on Wall Street in years as worries build about how much pain President Trump is willing to impose through tariffs on some of our key trading partners to get what he wants. Trump is dismissing business concerns over the uncertainty caused by his plans and says he's not ruling out the possibility of a recession this year, going back on his promise during the campaign to boost the economy immediately. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration layoffs of the federal workforce have reached almost every corner of the government, including professors and athletic coaches at the federally funded Indian Nations University in Kansas. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
It's been a turbulent month for Adam Strom. He's the head coach of the women's basketball team at Haskell Indian Nations University, one of only two post-secondary schools in the U.S. operated by the Federal Bureau of Indian Education. Last month, Strom got an ominous invitation from his boss.
I was called into his office. He closed the door and said, "You're on a list," which is an executive order, the Trump administration, and immediate termination.
It was Trump's executive order implementing DOGE's Workplace Optimization Initiative. It directed all federal agencies to undertake large-scale reductions in force. And the Bureau of Indian Education laid off probationary employees, including Strom.
There was a sense of embarrassment, like, you know, I'm an employee, like, I haven't done anything wrong, but I lost my job.
And it wasn't just Strom. At Haskell, about three dozen employees lost their jobs, from the dean of students to custodial staff. Add in some resignations, and in total, Haskell lost about a quarter of all of its employees.
Add to the list of broken promises, I feel like.
This is Bo Schneider, the president of the Board of Trustees of the Haskell Foundation, a nonprofit that supports the university. He explains Haskell, like many other federal services for Native Americans, isn't like other government programs or some kind of diversity initiative. Rather, he says the U.S. government has legal obligations that come from treaties struck with Indian tribal nations.
Part of those treaties oftentimes were requests to cede land or to relocate to other land in exchange for, you know, guarantee of, you know, health care, education.
These treaty obligations are the basis of a new federal lawsuit challenging the layoffs. Among the plaintiffs are four Haskell students who say instructors for classes they need for their degrees were laid off and their financial aid has been delayed. If the cuts aren't reversed, the lawsuit warns, Haskell could be at risk of losing its accreditation. The federal government has not yet responded to the lawsuit. Sophomore Aliona Spoonhunter, who isn't involved in the lawsuit, says it's all been an emotional roller coaster.
Being Native American woman, it's like we could never win, even though we are basically winning because we're still living to this day.
Spoonhunter is a center on the basketball team. She grew up on a couple different reservations, never quite fitting in. She says being at Haskell among a student body of other Natives, all from different backgrounds, has helped her to see more possibilities for what her life could look like.
There's comments saying, like, the school should be shut down, which is ridiculous because, like, we're just proof we're still here, you know?
And of course, the women's basketball season isn't over just yet. It's March. It's tournament time. The Haskell Fighting Indians overcame the odds to earn a spot in the NAIA Championship Tournament. They play Friday, and they'll be big underdogs as a 16 seed facing the top-ranked defending champions.
Let's bring it in one step closer.
Okay. On the court, there's a feeling of the players against the world. They're a team of Native Americans pushing back on what they feel is the latest in a long history of injustices.
A dream by yourself is simply a dream. Okay? A dream together is a reality.
After he was laid off, Coach Strom decided to stay on as a volunteer and work without pay to be there for his players through the end of the season. Last Friday, as the team huddled after practice, he had good news to share.
Speaking of dreams and realities, I received an email today and my dream became a reality.
About a third of the laid off staff members at Haskell were asked to return to their jobs.
All right, the subject line said, cancellation of termination.
There are 20 or so staff members who have not been reinstated. The Haskell Foundation has raised more than $160,000 to help pay for temporary contracts to employ them through the end of the semester.
Family on three. One, two, three. Family!
Strom's job is no sure thing. Some federal workers have been fired after being reinstated.
Every practice, every game, every day, like, I wanted to be the best version of myself. I didn't want to coach these ladies like a volunteer. I wanted to coach them like a professional they deserve.
Strom isn't looking for another more stable job right now, he says. He'd rather be here with his players than anywhere else. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Lawrence, Kansas.
Last week, actor Amanda Seyfried appeared on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. She brought something a bit unusual with her, a dulcimer.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news and sure looks bad. They won't give Tisa a chance.
Seyfried played a cover of Joni Mitchell's song California that quickly went viral. Now a new generation of Mitchell fans on TikTok are showing off the song's enduring appeal, as NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
Joni Mitchell released California in 1971. It's on her seminal album, Blue.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France.
And it's still speaking to listeners today, including Amanda Seyfried.
Her voice floats, the dulcimer floats, the way she holds it, the way she plays it, the way she sings with it. It's like they're one instrument.
That's Seyfried speaking to All Things Considered today. She loves the song California because
it's a celebration of a place that we all want to celebrate very badly right now.
California, California, I'm coming home.
Seyfried's viral cover is also resonating with people around the world, like 20-year-old Brenna Byrne.
I'm from Ireland originally, from Newry in the north of Ireland, but I'm currently on a study abroad in Paris, so that song really is quite special to me.
After Byrne saw Seyfried's clip on The Tonight Show, she posted her own.
Reading the news and it sure looks bad. Like, not much has changed even in 50 years.
Byrne says California speaks to her because it's a song about being homesick.
A lot of people can relate to, you know, you can go anywhere in the world, but sometimes all you want is a bit of comfort.
Byrne's video has been seen more than 200,000 times, and she's one of many people having their own covers of California go viral.
But I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here.
That's singer-songwriter Lucy Bernheim. She's been playing the dulcimer for 2 years.
I had a video, like, from the day I started learning it, of California, and I was like, oh, I'll post it, thinking my friends would see it and be like, oh my God, this is so silly. And then here we are.
That video now has nearly 800,000 views on TikTok.
The longevity of a song like California is because of its storytelling. What an instrument like the dulcimer does is keeps the storytelling of like a song at the forefront.
Oh, it gets so lonely when you're walking and the streets are full of strangers.
Bernheim says Joni Mitchell has been a huge inspiration to her.
What does Joni Mitchell's music mean to me? It means everything.
But whether you're a longtime fan or you just discovered her, Bernheim says this song has something for everyone.
For Joni, it's California. I think everyone has their California, though, that is where they want to return to, no matter where they've traveled.
So I bought me a ticket, I caught a plane to Spain.
Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
There were lots of pretty people there, reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue. I said, how long can you hang around?
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Most Americans live in a state where marijuana is now legal. That does not mean it is okay to drive while high, and that poses new challenges for traffic police. NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson has more.
Sergeant Tyler Millis of the Minnesota State Patrol is showing me a new roadside machine he and his fellow officers are trying out.
It's about the size of a Keurig machine.
But this machine doesn't make coffee. It analyzes spit.
It actually has a sliding door. That's where the cartridge goes in.
The cartridge looks like a kazoo with a little swab on top.
So we're going to have them put that cotton tip in their mouth and then swab their gums and under their tongue.
The machine will test for THC, the chemical in marijuana that makes you high.
The door gets shut.
The Minnesota State Patrol has piloted this device for the last year because around the country, more people are using marijuana and many are doing so before driving. That makes road safety experts nervous, like Pam Shadle-Fisher with the Governor's Highway Safety Association.
Essentially, we've left the horse out of the barn, so to speak.
Studies show THC can impair driving, slowing down reaction times and making people swerve.
We need to make sure that we have things in place to protect others in the event that someone chooses to consume cannabis and get behind the wheel and be impaired.
The data is mixed on how big of a problem driving while high is. In Colorado, for instance, fatal car crashes where a driver had THC in their blood went up after legalization. But the problem is, it's hard to determine whether a driver was high when they crashed.
When it comes to alcohol, the breath alcohol level is correlated very strongly with your blood alcohol level, which is correlated very strongly with your brain alcohol level.
That's Cinnamon Bidwell, a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. She says an alcohol breathalyzer is a pretty good stand-in for how drunk you are. But THC is tricky. It can stay in your system for even days after you're no longer high. We can reliably detect the presence of THC in blood and saliva.
But what does that mean? And is there a level that means somebody recently used or that somebody is actively impaired? The data aren't there yet.
Without that, she says states risk over-punishing people who do use but don't drive while high. Researchers are racing for an answer. They're studying those saliva tests, THC breathalyzers, apps that assess cognition, even goggles that measure pupil size. Colonel Matthew Packard, chief of the Colorado State Patrol, says that's why it's key to teach officers what to look for. A test, he says, is just another tool.
All that is confirming or supporting what you saw on the roadside. To use an ice cream analogy, the test is kind of like the cherry on the top. But ice cream is still great, even if it doesn't have the whipped cream and cherry.
Critics say relying on training is too subjective. Police make mistakes. But Packard wants his officers prepared with or without a test to back them up. In Minnesota, the State Patrol's saliva test pilot just ended. As did that test Officer Millis demonstrated for me.
And then it shows negative. So that's exactly what we wanted to see.
His department is now preparing a report for state lawmakers. But whether or not they continue to use the tests, he says there's also a role for the public to police themselves by planning a safe ride. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Even a simple task like buttoning a shirt relies on more than dexterity. It requires a sense of touch. NPR's John Hamilton reports on an effort to restore this sense in people who are paralyzed from a stroke or spinal cord injury.
In 2014, an engineer named Chad Boughton got a lesson on the importance of touch. Boughton, who's at the Feinstein Institutes for Medical Research on Long Island, had developed a brain-computer interface that allowed a man living with paralysis to move one hand.
He was trying to pick something up, and he was doing it. But then he turned around and he said to us, you know, Chad, I can't feel this object. And so at that moment, we realized, wow, that's what we need to work on next.
More than a decade later, that work is paying off for a man named Keith Thomas. A diving accident in 2020 left Thomas paralyzed and with no sensation from the chest down. In 2023, the team at Feinstein, a part of Northwell Health, implanted two sets of computer chips in his brain. One set detects signals in areas that control movement. The other delivers signals to areas that process touch and pressure. Thomas described the result during a video call from his home.
They hooked me up to the machine, and like, it was the first time I felt my index finger. I was like, whoa.
After more than a year of practice and lots of tweaks to the equipment, Thomas can pick up an object and tell researchers something about it.
I'd be like, it's a tennis ball or something heavier or something lighter.
Thomas is the first patient to receive what researchers call a double neural bypass. Boughton says the first branch bypasses the damaged area of the spinal cord.
We are literally rerouting signals from the brain to, say, muscles that are affected by a spinal cord injury in this case.
That allows Thomas to move his hand. At the same time, Boughton says, sensors on his palm, thumb, and index finger are sending signals back to the brain about what he's touching.
And then we have a second branch that reconnects the brain to the spinal cord. And as someone thinks about moving again, we stimulate the spinal cord based on their thoughts.
That amplifies and strengthens the remaining natural connections between the brain and an affected limb. It takes a lot of people and equipment to animate Keith Thomas's right hand for just a few hours. I get a quick overview from Arona Obrochi, Dana Fried, Annika Jungum, Ziv Elias, and Santosh Chandrasekaran.
First thing we do is greet him with a smile.
We do mobility testing. We do strength testing.
We have this pedestal that helps to collect the data from the motor cortex region.
And then we plug in a cable to the pedestal.
And that talks to the signal processor over there and the computer eventually.
Once Thomas is wired up, the real work begins. Chandrasekaran points to a monitor showing two animated hands. One indicates the motion Thomas is supposed to carry out. The other is controlled by Thomas's brain.
He cannot move his own hand, but he's trying to do that. The decoder figures out what he's thinking about and then controls the other hand on the screen to produce the output that he's thinking about.
The decoder also sends signals to the muscles controlling Thomas's actual hand, so it moves in sync with its on-screen avatar. Chandrasekaran says Thomas has much better control of his hand when it's fitted with the tiny sensors that add a sense of touch.
What we are measuring is the force levels on the sensor and then appropriately stimulating the right electrodes in the brain so that we can make him feel a sensory percept at the right location on the hand.
That allowed Thomas to feel his sister's hand when she made a visit to the lab. Boughton says another milestone came when they put a cup of water in front of him.
He lifted that cup up for the first time to his mouth, took a drink, and then set it back down all on his own without any help, any assistance from anyone.
At first, the improvements were only present in the lab. But over time, benefits like increased arm strength have persisted when he goes home. I asked Thomas if he does things now he couldn't do before.
Yeah, like pet my dog and stuff like that.
When you do pet your dog, do you feel anything?
I do, actually. My wrist, I can feel a little bit of the fur.
Thomas says eventually he hopes to be able to do things like brush his own teeth without assistance. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Should we call him King Charles or maybe DJ Royal Chuck? King Charles III has launched an Apple Music playlist of his favorite songs. It dropped today for Commonwealth Day, which is celebrated among a group of mostly former British colonies. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
In a video posted to social media, King Charles sits at a big wooden desk at Buckingham Palace with a vintage radio on-air sign lit up, talking about his love of disco, reggae, and Afrobeats.
It has that remarkable ability to bring happy memories
Then the video cuts to a military marching band outside the palace playing Bob Marley.
So this is what I particularly wanted to share with you. Songs which have brought me joy.
This playlist fit for a king is called the King's Music Room. The palace says it's the soundtrack of King Charles's life, from 1930 standards to Kylie Minogue.
The song is The Locomotion, and this is music for dancing. Again, it has that infectious energy which makes it, I find, incredibly hard to sit still.
I find it quite hard to conjure the image. And when I do conjure the image of listening to this stuff, I find it quite disturbing. So, you know.
Alexis Petridis, pop music critic at The Guardian, says he has some doubt as to whether the king really made this playlist himself. It is kind of hard to imagine Charles and Camilla rocking out to Crazy in Love by Beyonce or Hot, Hot, Hot by Arrow, but maybe not.
Who knows what goes on behind the doors of Buckingham Palace? Maybe it's a non-stop party soundtracked by Afrobeats.
The occasion for the King's debut playlist is Commonwealth Day. And so it's no coincidence that many of the songs are from those 56 countries with past ties to the British Empire. Ties, though, which have frayed in recent years, amid calls for reparations for slavery and other injustices that were part of the empire.
It's a bit more of a fraught relationship now than it ever was.
Corinne Fowler is an expert on colonialism at the University of Leicester in England. She recalls how when the king's son and daughter-in-law, Kate and William, tried to make a similar gesture of goodwill with a tour of Commonwealth nations in the Caribbean 3 years ago.
They had lots of crowds of people demonstrating and really pushing for reparations.
Barbados had recently dropped the king as its head of state. Other countries say they'll follow suit. And so the idea of a playlist about the Commonwealth coming from the king...
Well, I can't speak for the citizens of Commonwealth nations, obviously, but I imagine it feels like it's glossing over a lot of these ever-deepening fault lines.
She says it might sound a little tone-deaf. In his defense, the 76-year-old monarch says his playlist reflects the, quote, wonderfully diverse tapestry of the modern Commonwealth. And beyond, actually. Because it includes a handful of acts like Beyonce and Diana Ross from America, which managed to escape its royal ties quite a long time ago. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or for all ages.